This class today is mostly going to focus on recognition. Now, the fact that there are mental health needs is a bit controversial in itself. And so we're going to start by giving you some definitions and some parameters that will help focus this discussion, looking specifically at mental health issues. It's kind of a complicated subject, but notice this in Deuteronomy 28:28. This is a curse to the children of Israel, said if they disobeyed him. And among many other curses, the Lord shall smite thee with madness and blindness and astonishment of heart. So, there is a spiritual connection to mental health issues, and we don't want to ignore that in our discussion today. Mental health is primarily expressed in behavior, and so many times we're talking about behavior issues along with mind and comprehension issues. And so there will be some thoughts maybe tomorrow when we talk about addressing or working with people. We'll talk about the discipline side of things a little bit more. As an introduction, let's think a little bit about the whole concept of mental health. What do we mean when we say that someone has a mental health issue? What do we mean anyway? Is there any way to quantify it or to measure it? And that's why some of the objections surface whenever we start to explain a problem as a mental health problem. What do you mean? What do you mean? Really? There are three views that emerge in almost any discussion in the Christian context of mental health. The first view would be that mental health and mental illness is demonic in origin. So the antidote is to cast out the demons that are causing it. Second view would be mental health is psychobabble. There's no such thing as a mental disorder. All so-called mental illnesses are just sinful behaviors. And so the antidote is for a person to repent and get right with God, and that will take care of the issue. Or in the case of children, it's always and only a discipline issue. They haven't been taught, they haven't been trained, haven't been disciplined. That's one issue. Thomas Szasz, in 1961, wrote a book, The Myth of Mental Illness. And I have a number of copies. I never bought one of them. They get sent to me. Never mind, it was written before I was born. It is part of the controversy. When we talk about mental illness, the controversy that is it really this kind of an issue that we're talking about? All right, mental illness, as is also the third understanding, would be that it is a physiological disorder. The brain is a physical organ, just like the heart, the thyroid, the joints. And thus, if someone has panic attacks or bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or chronic depression, they have a neurological problem in the brain, not dissimilar to hyperthyroidism or high blood pressure or arthritis. Now, it's just not that simple, unfortunately. I grew up believing something in the middle, somewhere between number one and two there. But from life experiences, I've been more inclined to accept the reality of number three, but I will acknowledge that it is not that simple. Nor can we ignore, if we do accept the validity of the third premise, that it is a physiological problem, we can't accept that premise and ignore the reality of demonic activity, demonic influence, or sinful behavior. Those are real, valid concerns that we ought not to diminish in our minds when we're talking about mental illness. There's another discussion that I think would be good for us to think a little bit about before we go into some of the descriptions and symptoms. What good is a label? How many of you have heard of ADD, ADHD, ASD, RAD, BPD, OCD, ODD? I mean, you can, and that's just a few of them. They always end with D. Why?
Disorder.
Disorder, disorder, disorder. Let's have some discussion. What good is a label?
If it's correctly applied, it can help a broader range of people understand quickly what's wrong with the situation.
Okay. Can a label have a negative impact?
Can excuse any and all behavior.
Okay, well.
In theory.
Possibly.
Well, there's not a lot of benefit there's not a lot of answers in the label itself.
That's right.
You pill bottle, you don't get nothing but in the label.
That's right. That's an important point to remember, that just diagnosing something or labeling something doesn't solve any problem at all. However, it can quickly quantify a certain set of problems. The problem is, it's a two-edged sword. A label can validate somebody's experience. That, you know, they've lived with this disability, this problem, this difficulty for years and years, and never understood. And then one day they're talking with, maybe a counselor or somebody, and he says, well, you have the symptoms of, and gives them a way to understand it. And it can be tremendously validating. The problem is, it can also, a label can be used to invalidate just as easily as, well, they have depression. They don't count. They got a problem. And so we just thought it might be valuable to think a little bit about labels in that context. Let's use them wisely, judiciously. All right, and then another introductory remark I would like to share is just a little bit about my own personal experience and interest in this field. As I said, I grew up believing that the Lord took care of your mind, you took care of your body, and the Lord took care of your mind, and you know, that's kind of was the extent of my interest in the subject. After we were married, my wife and I began to experience periods where she grappled with fears that seemed irrational to me, and it seemed like, particularly as the years of childbearing came on, but we loved each other. It didn't destroy our marriage or anything like that. But after the birth of our fifth son, we discovered that we were in a quagmire of depression. I didn't know what it was, but you know, we'd pray our one foot out of the mud only to realize the other foot was in even deeper. And we were in a church setting that was not very sympathetic. I'm going to say this charitably, but we didn't have a support group network that we should have had. Eventually, I was desperate enough, we went to the doctor. And I went with, took my wife to the doctor, and it was just a family practitioner. It was a lady that we had visited before with different things over the years. And she asked a number of questions and gave us a prescription. Well, I went straight to the library. I wanted to know what this was, what this medication was, how it was supposed to work, what, you know, I was very skeptical. And I'm glad I did. One of the things I learned at the library that the doctor didn't teach me or tell us is that things are going to get worse before they get better. The way psychotropic medications work, it's often that way. And the next 2 weeks were really rough, but I had read enough that I was prepared, at least somewhat, for it. But I still remember the coming home from work. My wife had painted the boys' bedroom that day. She was back in her artistic, creative personality. We've struggled with that ever since. It's not, she still takes medication for depression. But it started me on a journey of awareness and understanding, so that when, fast forward to when our second son was 17 years old, and he was on a trip with his grandparents, my father, and I got this phone call in the wee hours of the morning asking me if my son ever had times when he didn't make sense. And my father started to describe what was happening. He was in a foreign country. And it was started us on a journey with bipolar mania that further instructed us in this field of mental health. Well, I could sit here and tell stories, but that's not really going to be entirely helpful. But it opened a whole new spectrum of frightening possibilities of mental disintegration, disorganization. And I just want to share this testimony that God has been faithful. We have been blessed. Our home had all the potentials of being a dysfunctional home. It's not. We have a blessed family. Lord blessed my wife and I with 9 boys and 2 girls, and now we have 23 grandchildren, and they are faithfully serving God at this point. We know that they all have choices to make and decisions that maybe in 25 years the picture will look different than it does today, but we are blessed in so many ways. And so we come to this realization that mental health is not entirely a spiritual matter, and yet, because our mind and our spirit are so integral to who we are, we can never separate the mind and the spirit and how they work together. And any person who is grappling with mental illness experiences it as an intensely spiritual battle. Remember that. There are difficulties that arise in human experience that we can properly label as mental health issues, even though we can't always understand their origin, what we wish we could understand better, and that's what we want to take a look at today. Some of the markers that might clue us into issues and difficulties that we may be working with that haven't exactly put it together. Then one more thing I'd like to underline before we go into symptoms. In the context of children especially, the mind is undergoing tremendous change. The mind of a child is developing and growing, and so especially through the periods of hormonal changes in the body, and these do affect the mind, and so there will be periods of time in a child's life when they may have sets of symptoms or something that we might question. I get these calls sometimes from parents that are concerned, and one of the things I ask is the age, because there are certain ages where there are so many changes happening in the body and in the mind that give it some time. Don't be in a hurry to label it. That's that's just some of the, because some of these developmental issues are not necessarily to be confused with mental health issues, at least not in the long term. I am actually very, very hesitant to recommend any type of medical intervention in a growing child. I maybe there would be cases that I would feel that differently about that, but I feel like during the processes of development, there are enough pathways of teaching and training to help a child develop and grow that we shouldn't just quickly alter that process through medication. I believe we need to wait for the developmental processes to run their full course and rely on the neuroplasticity of the human brain in our work with children rather than drug-based intervention. Now, I'm going to read you a definition of mental health this is from Wikipedia. And I just want you to think about all the different things they're trying to cover here. Mental health encompasses emotional, psychological, and social well-being, influencing cognition, perception, and behavior. According to World Health Organization, it is a state of well-being in which an individual realizes his or her abilities, can cope with the normal stresses of life, can work productively and fruitfully, and can contribute to his or her community. Likewise, it determines how an individual handles stress, interpersonal relationships, and decision-making. Mental health includes subjective well-being, perceived self-efficacy, autonomy, competence, intergenerational dependence, and self-actualization of one's intellectual and emotional potential, among others. Cultural differences, personal philosophy, subjective assessments, and competing professional theories all affect how one defines mental health. Some early signs related to mental health difficulties are sleep, irritation, lack of energy, lack of appetite, thinking of harming oneself or others, self-isolating, and frequently zoning out. That's the definition I got out of Wikipedia. Way more than we're going to cover here. But the thing I want you to just take note of in that is that we're talking about a sense of well-being. We all are different. Every one of us relates in our own signature ways and patterns. And healthy has more to do with the sense of being able, being competent, being functional, rather than any particular way. It's not a prescriptive that if a person does this and this and this and relates in this and this way, they're healthy. Well, yes and no. Because what's healthy for one person might not actually fit the next person. I remember after our son's episode, we got to working with a psychiatrist that he was from India. He had a real deep accent, and I was enjoying my relationship with him. I was enjoying his perspective, and he liked my curiosity too. And I have a book in my library that I was reading one day while he was meeting with my son, and it's big thick book on bipolar. And when he came out, he saw I was reading. He said, "Would you like that book?" He said, "You can have it." Wasn't until after I got home that I looked on the back page. It was a $150 book. It was a college-level text on research relating to bipolar. I still consult its case histories. It's very, very fascinating. Anyway, this man, Dr. Ahmed, I thought maybe it'd be good for my wife to visit with him a little bit. You know, she just was working with a local practitioner. So we made an appointment and sat down and talked. And so he asked her, "Well, Mrs. Martin, what can I do for you?" And she said, "Well, I just want to be normal." And he got the biggest smile on his face. Why, Mrs. Martin, what is normal? And he said, are you comfortable? Can you do your work? You know, those are valid questions. Are you comfortable? Can you do your work? So mental health has not to do with a specific way of relating so much as being comfortable that you can do, you can perform, you can relate, you can be productive, you can be successful. And we know that the definitions of that vary greatly. All right, let's go on to look at a few things we might encounter in children. Let's stop here just for a bit and open it up. Maybe in this discussion about the whole field and the controversies and definitions, maybe you have something you'd like to ask or discuss a little bit before we go any further.
So just to clarify, you would say that it's not as simple as just saying that mental health is a physical ailment. It's more than that.
It's hard always. To me, it's difficult to always, at least initially, specify whether it's a spiritual problem creating physical symptoms, or whether it's a physical problem that feels like spiritual reality. I don't think. All right. So, to me, it's one of those things where if you're going to help somebody, you have to look at both. They're so interconnected. You have to pray with somebody and go to the doctor with them. You have to, you know, you can't, to me, you can't split them. Now, in reality, there are people that ignore the spiritual side of life and have perfectly sound minds, and, you know, they don't struggle with mental health. There's people that spend way more time in prayer than I do that grapple with whether they're right with God or not, you know. And so, yeah, there's physical issues, there's spiritual issues. Anyone else?
Just to clarify, did I hear you say that generally mental issues are experienced as spiritual issues?
They are. That's my observation. In other words, even children that are grappling with, say, anxiety or OCD, they'll often be thinking that God is involved in this thing. You know, that's just often it's linked together. Sense of guilt, a sense of fear, sense of they have to please God in some way. And I struggle with that sometimes, you know. Why can't these innocent people just be sick? You know, why does it have to twine itself into spiritual frameworks like that?
Do you feel that's a particular viewpoint? Is that a Christian viewpoint, or is that more just the way it is for everybody?
I find that even in secular literature that you know they will comment on the connection to guilt and shame and fear, you know, outside of just the person's behavior, the sense, and it seems to me like that something has short-circuited or gone wrong in the mental processes, but we are a spiritual being, and we have a conscience, and we have a consciousness, and that all gets tangled into it.
I would just share that last week I was in public transportation, and right ahead of me there were two young people talking about mental health, and it went into the spiritual dimension in a way that I found extremely fascinating. By the way, I wasn't eavesdropping. They were the noisy ones on the air. They went right into the spiritual and started talking about keeping the devils out of your life and that sort of stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was mental health was the core of their discussions.
That's my experience as well. Let's think a little bit now about anxiety. To me, it's important for us to think about, there's a difference between an anxious child and anxiety as a mental health concern. Every child has times of anxiousness and anxiety, you know, and the point that needs to raise the flags in our mind is when it's impairing day-to-day functions and it just continues. I mean, when you address one anxiety and another one is there in its place, or when you change one condition but the anxiety just shifts. So anxiety, some children are just by nature more anxious. I have a granddaughter that, you know, she gets up in the morning and she's barely finished with breakfast and she's thinking about getting to school on time. And she's making sure her siblings all, you got your lunch, you got your shoes, you got your backpacks, you got, you know, it's a point of concern with her. Not a mental health issue. It's a personality. Anxiety as a mental health concern is when it affects sleep, when it affects the ability to relate to other people, when it affects the ability to think about other things, concentrate, think through things, when it includes a sense of doom or danger that are not realistic, you know. And we know that children have periods, you know, maybe they hear about a bad storm in some other state and somebody lost their lives and the house blew down. Well, then the next time a thunderstorm comes along, you know, they're anxious. That's normal. There's nothing incongruent about that. What is not normal is if someone is anxious about, you know, the house burning down when there isn't really any reason for that fear to be there, or some other sense of doom that comes upon them. And so that's the point about mental health or mental illness. It's always an aberration of the normal. In other words, anxiety is normal. Children have times when they're anxious about things, but so is the ability to relieve that anxiety, you know, with parental love, and when we cannot relieve it, that's where we start to get concerned. When the child is surrounded with security and safety, and yet the sense of doom remains, that's where we start to get concerned. Same thing would be true of things like depression. We have, you know, every teenager goes through times of, I mean, we were all young, and, you know, the transition from childhood carefree to adult, there are times of intense feeling down, feeling like the world is hanging on you, like something's wrong, and those feelings come and go, and that's why we teach our children, don't take your feelings so seriously. You know, life is okay. You're gonna grow up. I remember a dad that was in the lawn care business, and he had this teenage son riding with him, and he just knew something was wrong. This son was just morose and wouldn't talk, and they'd get done with one job and they'd ride to the next job, and this dad was getting more and more burdened for his son. His son was just obviously, he was afraid there was some deep spiritual problem. And finally he just parked the mower and said, we got to talk. And, yeah, you got a problem, what's going on? Son said, all I'm ever going to do is mow lawns. I mean, I'm just going from one lawn to the next, and that's all I've ever done, so I'm ever going to do. And, you know, this was a 15-year-old boy or whatever. And dad said, I just about rolled out on the ground laughing. They said, that's me. That's all I'm ever going to do. You're going to grow up and go on. Yeah, okay, so, That's not a mental health issue. I mean, it's just the feeling of depression, the feeling trapped. And okay, that's normal. Again, we have times when we feel like life has got us in a box and there's no way out. And that's life. Much of this is just problems of living. It's not anything to get worked up about. When we start to get concerned, as though when there isn't a context for it, you know, when there isn't a reason for someone to feel trapped, and when we see significant withdrawal from things that normally would be recreative and refreshing, you know, when the child begins to withdraw from play, for instance, or they begin to withdraw from social activities, and they start to talk about dark things and express themselves as wishing to die or things like that. That's when we start to recognize that maybe we have a deeper, more pervasive thing going on and need to start to address it from that way. The important thing is that all of these things need to have a context. If someone has just lost a loved one, a parent or a sibling, and they're going through a period of darkness, wishing to die, things like that's grief. It's not anything to panic about. It's nothing. We want to walk with them through it. We want to support them through it. We actually want them to grieve. We actually want them to go through that valley, and we want to go through it with them. If they have trouble sleeping through that time, that's normal. It's when there isn't a context like that, and you're facing those sorts of issues, sleep issues and lack of interest in daily life and wishing to die, that's when we start to get concerned. Well, let's look a little bit at some of the letter terms. OCD. How many of you are familiar with obsessive compulsive disorder? How many of you have worked with somebody with it? Anybody have worked with somebody that has? Okay, so it's fairly common. It's not. We're glad it's not more, but it's something that we need to sometimes pay attention to the symptoms. The term obsessive compulsive disorder has two components: obsessions and compulsions. The obsession is the thought process. The compulsion is the behavior to medicate the thought process. So if Johnny gets obsessed with whether the door is locked, you know, the nighttime comes and you know you want to be safe, and so you want to lock the door. And so he makes sure it's locked. But then he starts to think about it. Am I sure it's locked? And so he starts to check it. And then he checks it again, but then he has the thought again. And the only way to deal with the thought is to check it again. But checking relieves it only for a little, and then the thought occurs again, and the checking occurs again. So you have the thought side of it, and then the behavior side of it. And it can get so distressing, depending on the type of obsession it is. Obsessive compulsive can involve unwanted thoughts, impulses, or images. Sometimes it veers into things that make us even uncomfortable to talk about, get obsessive thoughts that cause anxiety and distress. Sometimes obsessive compulsive disorder gets expressed in extremely rigid arranging things. Counting out certain quantities and arranging them in certain ways, and then being sure that something, you know, it's not quite right, so you have to rearrange it and recount it and rearrange it and recount it, that type of thing. It can involve rituals or rules that have to be followed to do something, maybe like going to bed, or has to happen in a certain sequence, a certain way, or it's not done right. And that rigidity can be very distressing to break that rigidity. We're going to talk a little bit about therapies tomorrow, just on the recognition side of it, whenever you see someone, a child particularly, that seems very conscious of sequence and order and very rigid in those things, you might want to just pay a little attention, whether it's escalating or whether it's just a phase they're going through. Again, sometimes in a certain period of development, these things will emerge, and then they'll kind of fade out on their own. Am I supposed to be done by 4 o'clock? Okay. Let's talk about paranoia. This is where it gets into the deeper troubles. Paranoia is the irrational, persistent feeling that people are out to get you, or persistent, intrusive attention, like somebody is tracking you or somebody is following you. This isn't as common in children, thankfully. But in children, it might show up more as being very sensitive to criticism, or very quickly offended by something that happens, and not able to self-regulate and get past the emotional, the normal emotional give and take of life, but and a tendency to read other people as having negative intent. We all know that tendency to see the negative, you know, to think about, why did he look at me that way, you know? And then we have, we just dismiss it. But when a paranoia starts to develop, it cannot quite be dismissed that way. Paranoia can be situational. In other words, there's all kinds of technical terms for different types of paranoia, and I wanted to say that right up the front. I'm not going to be technical here today or in these talks. I just want to give you some general overviews of some of the problems that you might encounter if you're trying to help people with mental health issues, but there are many technical definitions. Paranoia can be very situational. Some people have panic attacks if they go into crowds of people. They feel distressed by people. Some people just feel very unsafe in a large open space. Some people feel unsafe in a closed space. These fear thing, it tends to be a fear-centered emotion, but it's triggered by various types of encounters. My wife switched medication one time, and she started to experience paranoias that she had never experienced before. We quickly went off, but during that time, I started getting this phone call from her. I'd be at work, and I'd get this phone call from her, and she would just start talking, and it was just a little unusual that I'd get this at the time of the day it was, and I'd listen, because I knew she had struggles with things, and I'd be kind of keeping my ear open. What are you doing? Well, she's walking around outside poking at the flowers. My wife does lots of gardening, that's normal, but while we were talking, she would go into the house. And then after a while, she'd be done and hang up. And it happened a couple days in a row, and I'm starting to try to understand what's going on. Here, when she'd come home from hauling school children, she would just know that there was somebody in the house. There was somebody in there. It wasn't safe for her to go in there. And she just couldn't get up the courage to go in there. And so she would call me. And she'd walk around outside and talk with me a while. And then she'd walk, then she could go into the house. If something bad happened, well, at least I would be on the phone, you know. And she'd reassure herself that nobody was in there. And then she'd be okay. Well, it was escalating. And we soon learned that we needed to go a different direction with that. But paranoias don't make sense. I mean, but they're fear-based, and they can be very debilitating. And they can go into the field of personality disorders where it actually distorts the ability to relate to other people or even relate to yourself. There are terms like paranoid personality disorder, delusional paranoid disorder, and schizophrenia. And probably we've heard these terms, but it's when you get into the field of personality disorders, it can be, there's been a lot of progress in the last even 25 years in being able to address the underlying chemistry involved in some of these problems, and I'm thankful for that. But when a person has what, and I might be just explain a little bit what I mean by personality disorder. When a person has a personality disorder, they have a hard time sensing their own person and understanding another person. When we talk about borderline personality disorder, it's not a borderline problem. It's that the boundaries of my person have disappeared. And someone with this disorder may believe that they are controlling someone else's thoughts, or that someone else is controlling their thoughts, or that what they think is being broadcast over in Russia, or it has to do with losing the sense of personhood, you know, that I am me, I'm this person, I have these thoughts, and they're mine. They're not anybody else's, and nobody else is making me think what I think, and I'm not making anyone else. I mean, we don't even think about those things, really. I mean, we just know that, right? And yet, whenever these types of paranoias develop, they can erase that, and it can be very disturbing and very difficult to relate to someone who is confused in those ways. Now, thankfully, childhood schizophrenia is very uncommon. Schizophrenia is one of these types of personality, and it's related to the paranoia. When my son was diagnosed with bipolar, the first diagnosis was schizophrenia, and that struck a cold knife into my soul. I just knew it was bad. I didn't know that much about it at that point yet. But then as we worked our way through it and we met with some more professionals, the difference between mania, which my son had full-blown mania, and schizophrenia, it has to do with the hallucination part of it. A schizophrenic hears voices, sees people that don't exist. Now, my son, he knew he was being told to do things, but when the doctor quizzed him down about, well, did you hear it with your ears or did you hear it with your feelings? Well, he heard it with his feelings. He just knew. Well, that's... Now, these things are spectrum, so that just placed him at this spot on the spectrum. But the schizophrenia, he or she actually hears instruction, hears voices, sees things, And it's delusional. I mean, it's not real. That's why it does right away raise the question, well, are there spirits involved? Are there demons involved? But in the early stages of schizophrenia, it generally follows things like problems with thinking and reasoning, bizarre ideas or speech, things said that, where's that coming from? Confusion about what's reality, and this can manifest in children. It tends to be accompanied with withdrawal and lacking motivation. The thing about speech, and so when a mind is racing, which bipolar mania or even schizophrenia can trigger an avalanche of mental activity that it's disorganized, but it's very rapid. I know when my son was in one of his manic spells, he would be saying things and I couldn't make any sense out of what he was saying. It was words. I understood the words, but I didn't. What was happening was he was thinking about three or four words in between the words he was getting said. And so he would say his word, and the speech was really pressured and fast. And if I, what do you mean? And, you know, try to slow him. Well, then, well, I guess my thoughts are jumping around, you know, and you know, we'd eventually try to make a rational conversation out of it. But that, if there's that kind of disorganization in speech and logic, it is a sign that you might want to get more help. That this type of mental problem, the paranoia, the schizophrenia, actually needs intervention. Because the longer it runs, the more disorganized the mind can get, and the more it cuts grooves and opens pathways of disorder. And I would just recommend any parent that has a child that has disorganized or illogical thinking to try to get a professional involved. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. I see we're running out of time. I should give... delusions, hallucinations, disorganized thinking, extremely disorganized or abnormal motor behavior. I was going to talk a little bit about some of the neurological symptoms that we... So how many of you understand what I mean by Tourette's syndrome? That's where you have a neurological difficulty that creates tics and movements, involuntary movements. It's often related to and can be connected with other types of disorders, but sometimes it stands alone. Often, if it's just mild, it will be outgrown, but it is something that's happening also in the brain, in the mind, and can cause a lot of anxiety to parents. Often, the good thing about it is it doesn't usually impair intellectual ability. It's a mind condition, but it's not going to really probably affect the intellectual ability. Well, any questions here? We really should get dismissed here shortly, but maybe there's some things that you'd just like to clarify a little bit. I know I missed a lot of things here. Oh, on the OCD. How many of you have heard of the NJR emotion? Not just right. The NJR emotion is something doesn't feel just right. Not just right. And in a study of OCD, very normal people like you and me were given medication to specifically give them that feeling that something wasn't just right. And they all behaved obsessively. We can't live with that feeling. We have to do something about it. You think about it. When you feel like something isn't right, you do something about it, right? I mean, that's just the way we're made. And so when you think about a child that is living with this feeling that something is not right, they're going to try to get rid of that feeling. And so we'll talk about some of the therapies that work with that tomorrow. But anyway, I just wanted to comment on that, how you can't live with that feeling. Anything? Well, thank you for your interest and attention. It's a big subject. We're not really going to get very far in these two sessions, but I'm glad you're interested. You're dismissed.
Thank you.
Oh, I was going to read one verse yet here. Just hang on a second. Somewhere here I have it. So I'm... let's see. I have it on my notes here somewhere. Guess I didn't get to the bottom of my notes. That's why it's Psalm 37. Just a word of comfort. And the Psalms have a lot of comfort for people in mental distress. And I think we want to use them generously with people if we're trying to help people with distress. But just one that comes to my attention. Where am I here? For some reason I'm not seeing what I'm looking for. Oh, I'm in the wrong chapter. Psalm 34. Thy mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens, and thy faithfulness reacheth unto the clouds. And then we'll drop down. I'm still not seeing the verse I'm looking for. Oh, I got a new Bible. I'm struggling with it. Psalm 34:17. The righteous cry, and the Lord heareth and delivereth them out of all their troubles. The Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart, and saveth such that are of a contrite spirit. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivereth him out of them all. That's the comfort that I wanted to leave you with. We face these things as afflictions, and that's what I tell my son. I said, well, it's an affliction. You know, he calls me and he's distressed. It's an affliction. You just have to bear it. It's part of life. Some people are afflicted in one way and some in another, and these are hard to bear. You're dismissed.